Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Lob podcast from These Football Times. My name's Gary Thacker, and we're back with another episode in Series 2 of Mount Rushmore, where we ask invited guests to select the four players, one goalkeeper, one defender, one midfielder, and one forward, who they believe deserve to be immortalised on their club's very own Mount Rushmore monument. It's not necessarily about the best players, the longest serving, or the top goal scorer. It's for each guest to decide the players that they feel the most deserving. Before I introduce this week's guest and ask him to tell us a little bit about the club he's chosen, I introduce my co-host tonight. We're on our own tonight, Aidan again. It's Aidan Williamson. Welcome on board, buddy.
Evening there, Gary. Yes, looking forward to another one, and we're making do without Stephen again, but you know, we can manage without him just skiving off again. It's all good. Another excellent episode to get into. Another very interesting club with lots of fine stories and more fine players than you probably first think when you delve into it. So there's plenty to discuss. Yeah. Lots of interesting characters and lots of interesting stories. So yes, very much looking forward to this one.
Yes, we'll leave Steve on the treatment table for another week and perhaps I'll get him back for the next episode. But for this one, we've got an old friend of These Football Times podcasts back with us. It's the author of the fantastic Magical Magyars book, David Bailey. But David's not going to talk about the Hungarian team today, so... Hello, David. Tell us about the club you're going to talk about, mate, and why you chose them.
Yeah, good evening, fellas. Thank you for having me on. It's the mighty Crystal Palace.
And why Crystal Palace, David?
Why? Well, I'm from the Crystal Palace area. When I was a kid, and I kind of understood that they were a local team, and they was always on the back of the Croydon Advertiser, and then so I kind of from that age. I got my dad to pester my dad to take us down there to the Palace, and he did. And then from then on, it's been a lifelong love affair, really.
Yeah,
it's been a lifelong.
I'm a perfectly reasonable mate, and I suppose that's a story that you know so many people can identify with. And you know, as you mentioned, Aidan, you know, Crystal Palace is one of these clubs that you know at first that you know they sort of seem to be a fairly middling sort of a club, but they've had some outstanding players playing from over the years, haven't they?
We have over the years. And I think we can firmly say, I mean, I know probably Millwall and Charlton would disagree, maybe Wimbledon as well. But I think we're South London's number one now. Now Arsenal moved away. I don't know where they went to.
But Arsenal, whatever happened to them?
Yeah,
mate.
Whatever happened to them.
Well, Newcastle sort of broke the hearts a few days ago. The time of recording is just after Arsenal got lost at 2-0 at Newcastle and seemingly missed the chance to qualify the Champions League. But Aiden's got a smile on his face, so we don't care about that too much, do we, Aiden?
Exactly. Poor old Arsenal. So, yes, that serves them right for moving away from South London, clearly. Revenge has been, I don't know, 100 years in the making there. Yeah. But Crystal Palace got so many great characters. I think, obviously, they leapt into wider consciousness for people of my age anyway with the magnificent FA Cup performances in 1990, obviously the semi-final was astonishingly good. It's a shame Stephen's not here to talk about that one.
Yeah, I know. I think he's swinging the lead. You know, he doesn't want to.
Exactly, it's too painful. It's been 32 years, and he hasn't got over it.
Is it really 32 years? Yeah, I was there. Sorry, at Villa Park. So I went to Villa Park that, because that was a season we got beat 9-0, didn't we? Before,
yes, right.
Well, exactly, and that just made the story all the better, and that's why where I say they sort of leapt into the consciousness of people of my generation, well, I guess of others as well, but, you know, for me, that was the first real time that Crystal Palace forced their way into my mind in a bigger way than just being another team in the league, if that makes sense, and not to denigrate in any way, but obviously the 9-0... It kind of made you think, well, that's a certain status of Palace, and not to say they're the only ones who are roundly beaten by big teams, because they're not. But to then, in the same season, with a few changes, obviously, key ones in goal probably being the main one, but you know, a few changes, but not a lot. Largely the same group of players.
Yeah, I know, it's quite amazing.
To rally round and then win in that style against a team of that caliber was astonishing. And then to go so close to winning the final against Manchester United as well. So, you know, they sort of forged a place in everybody's affections, I think, from that year with the way they played, a lot of the characters. And I don't know whether you would class that as Crystal Palace's greatest ever team, but in my mind, from certainly of recent decades, it is. So you do as well. Because, I mean, a lot of the players from that time went on to big things, of course. A lot of familiar names. But what a team it was. And they had several years together in sort of peak time and great stuff. So that's how they sort of forced their way into my mind and stayed there ever since. Although I do actually recall, speaking of Newcastle United, one of the earliest games I ever went to in the early 80s was Newcastle Crystal Palace. I couldn't tell you what happened, what the score was, but I distinctly remember writing about it in what I did at the weekend in first school. But it would have been in the second division in those days. But yeah, so they've been in my mind a long time, I guess, but then they forced their way back to the front of the mind in 1990.
Yeah, well, they've certainly had some interesting players playing for them, some outstanding players. And we're going to talk about some of them today. I'm going to start with goalkeepers. So before you tell us who you picked as your choice for Mount Rushmore, the goalkeeper, David, who came close, buddy?
Well, I've got a list of three goalkeepers here I wrote down, four goalkeepers in all.
Yeah.
But the first one was a guy called John Jackson, who was a goalkeeper from 1964 to 73.
I remember him.
This is a guy who played 222 consecutive games, which is going some.
Definitely.
But I didn't see him play, and it's not that... it's not that I didn't choose anyone I haven't seen play, but I don't think Palace came into our own before Malcolm Allison took charge. I think before then we weren't. I think Charlton were a bigger team in South London, and I think John Jackson was there before. I think in 73, so he would have been just there when Allison was there. Maybe Allison didn't fancy him, but anyway, I was watching a match once, and an old timer behind me, he said, "Oh, he's not a scratch on John Jackson." It kind of stuck in my head that he was. But you saw him play.
Yeah,
Gary,
I remember playing John Jackson. Yeah, more than decent goalkeeper. He played at a time when there was a lot of outstanding English goalkeepers, but you know, in another area, he could well have got caps. But a solid, dependable, good goalkeeper, John Jackson. Yeah. I remember him well. Yeah.
And the second chap I got is John Burridge.
Oh,
who, he was the Palace. We had the team of we had. I'm sure the listeners know that we had a team of the 80s, which was under Terry Venables, and Burridge was the goalkeeper. But I was under the assumption he was at the Palace for far longer than he was. He was there for a couple of years, but I'm not even sure he was that great a goalkeeper, to be honest with you. I mean, he's probably better than me, but I mean, I think he was more of a character than a great goalkeeper. I mean, I imagine that the first match I went to, when you're a kid, you always stand behind the goal, didn't you?
Yeah.
On the assumption that's, and it is kind of the best place to stand and the worst place to stand. And we stood behind the goal, and there was John Burridge. And I like to think he had his cap on at a jaunty angle, and he was doing handstands. He probably wasn't.
He probably was.
He probably was, yeah. But I mean, I think he done more so at your team, Newcastle, didn't he, Aidan? And probably Wolves, he was there for a bit. But I mean, I wrote me down somewhere, 29 clubs.
Wow.
He was at over. There's some going, some. I don't know if that's a good thing or bad thing. We know whether they want him out the door or...
Although quite a lot of those were towards the end of his career. He sort of bounced around as a sort of handyman goalkeeper to fill in the gaps whenever they appeared in a squad. You know, if your goalie's gone injured or is suspended for the last few games of the season, who you're calling up? It seemed to be John Burridge for a time. And I think he forged a nice little end of career in that way. But he was a great character. He was... he always seemed like angry and slightly crazed.
Yeah, he was. Yeah.
He was off the wall. And
he was a kind of bloke who would dive on concrete, wouldn't he?
Absolutely, he would. He would just fling himself at the feet of whoever was coming in at him and get kicked many a time. He played in a playoff semi-final, Newcastle against Sunderland in 90. That was probably 1990 as well, actually. And we lost overall. Sadly, but the first leg he saved a penalty at Sunderland and got he saved it and then got kicked in the head from the follow-up from the Sunderland player, That's just what he did. You know, I think that's just the kind of man he was. He was crazy, slightly wacky. He was always, like I say, angry, growling, aggressive, intense. But these are the kind of characteristics that stand out on the field. You know, that the fans can see them. And they might not see themselves in it, but you warm to that a little bit because you see somebody who's just giving everything for your team. Slightly mental, definitely, but that added to his appeal.
Yeah, I make you right.
One of these characters that sort of epitomised that old sort of maxim about goalkeepers. You have to be crazy to be a goalkeeper. Well, he sort of fitted that that part like a glove. So who was your last one there, David, that didn't quite make it?
The third one is Nigel Martin, who, talking of the 9-0, I think he replaced... He got bought in place of Perry Sutcliffe. And now I'll just give a mention to old Perry because he couldn't have been that bad a goalkeeper. I mean, he must have felt terrible after that match. He must have, because I don't know. I think he came from Manchester City or vice versa. I'm not quite sure, but I mean, Division One goalkeeper puts 9 goals past him. So Stevie Coppell goes and buys Nigel Martin, who at the time £2 million was. I think it was certainly Crystal Palace's most expensive purchase, but whether he was English football's most expensive goalkeeper, which I think he was.
I think he was the first £1 million goalkeeper, at the time, I guess he would be.
That's how much I like him. I doubled his worth, see? But I think, in our opinion, he was the best ever goalkeeper for Crystal Palace. He was just kept out of the England team by David Seaman. And also, but I listened to your last series on the Mount Rushmore, and Gary, you had a Leeds United chap on there.
Yes.
And he put Nigel Martin in there. I really don't want to confuse visitors for your Mount Rushmore.
that's an interesting point. What will we do with people? Can't we have two Mount Rushmore? Can you have two different identities? And, you know, I mean, that's an interesting one. I'd have to consider that. I mean, fortunately.
It hasn't actually happened yet at all. So this, I guess, is the very closest we've come to our
And I don't want to be putting your chisel down, Gary, because an honest day's work, never done a Chelsea fan any harm.
I mean, I wouldn't know, mate. Yeah? I mean, you know, I wouldn't know. I mean, there's three really interesting selections there. I mean, you know, John Jackson, as you say, is sort of... we're going back, so best part of 50 years now with John Jackson when he was playing. But Burridge and Nigel Martin, you probably couldn't have had more contrasting characters. Nigel Martin unassuming. I think he played for England in the game where Beckham scored that late equaliser for the World Cup after the free kick. I think he played.
He was in Euro 2000 as well because he was the late replacement. Seaman played the first two, but then got injured ahead of the decisive group game with Romania. Yeah. So Nigel Martin came in for that. Probably not fully prepared, which is unfortunate for him because I guess it was a big moment in his career getting to play in the tournament. It didn't go so well in the end in terms of the game. I think he was a very last-minute replacement there, so that's a shame.
It's interesting that there again, I suppose, much as I was mentioning about John Jackson earlier, I mean, if it wasn't for Seaman, I don't know how many caps Nigel Martin got, but it would have been a hell of a lot more if Seaman had been there. It's all about time, I suppose, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, okay. So, yeah, some decent candidates there, but you've chosen somebody else, Dave. So who's your choice for Mount Rushmore, the goalkeeper, mate?
The choice is Julian Speroni. He was a guy, Argentinian, signed in 2004 by Ian Dowie from Dundee. Yeah, from Dundee he was signed. And interestingly, before joining Dundee, he'd only played a handful of games in Argentina. I'm not sure how he wound up at Dundee. I think that there was an Argentinian player at Dundee already who knew him and brought him there. But he came to us in 2004, and he was there for 15 years, which is going some. And, I mean, during them 15 years, he played under managers like Tony Pulis, Sam Allardyce, Neil Warnock, Ian Holloway, and these are chaps who don't suffer falls gladly. And so, I mean, admittedly, for the first 3 years, he was second choice to Gábor Király, the Hungarian guy with the tracksuit bottoms. And then, he sort of sealed his first team place, and he stayed there for the next 7 years. And he really was very, very good, very dependable, very good with his feet. Bowler Camp's a really nice guy. And I think we were Division One then. We were lower down the division. And not the Division One, Championship, sorry.
Yeah.
Championship. And I'll get us confused with Sunderland. That's me. And so But for a 7-peat period between 2007 and 2014, he was way by far the best goalkeeper in that league. And considering the shenanigans that happened in 2010 when we went into administration, it was surprising we didn't sell him or he didn't want to leave. And I was discussing this with my brother, who to choose, and he said, oh, we should Julian Speroni, he said, for loyalty. But I'm just not sure how loyal football players are, really. I mean, we're loyal. The clubs themselves, I don't know about that. I think they pay lip service to being loyal. But, I mean, Speroni was loyal. And, he wasn't even that. I mean, he was a very good goalkeeper, but he never played at Argentinian for the national team at any level.
You do tend to find, of any position on the pitch, goalkeepers are the sort of players that seem to stick there longer. But by anybody's measure, 15 years, Zayden, is a massive time to spend with one club, isn't it?
Oh, it really is. And I think it's something to do with goalkeepers that helps that longevity. I think they're hard to budge from a team. There's only one goalkeeper you can play, obviously. And I think, unlike other positions where it is possible to play two right backs, you could play them as part of a back four. You could play them as part of a back three. You could play one in front of the other. You know, there are ways and means of forcing two other players of the same position into the same team. You obviously can't do that with a goalkeeper. And to make a change at goalkeeper it's a big deal because it's such a rock of the formation. You know, it's the thing that it's all built off. And without that solid base, all else could fall apart. So to actually make a change there is quite a big decision. And therefore, I think it's something that isn't taken lightly. I think, you know, we've all seen goalkeepers who don't last that long. So when things go wrong, obviously people move swiftly and replace it. But once you've got someone who is working well, who's performing well and is working well with the team, I think to make a change, to risk making a change, to try for an upgrade where it isn't obvious that it would necessarily be an upgrade, isn't always the easiest thing to do. And therefore, they stick longer. And I think, you know, the loyalty goes two ways, doesn't it? So that's the club's loyalty towards the player, as long as they keep delivering, but the player's loyalty as well. In this case, I think, you're right, questioning about loyalty from players in certain cases, but there's still enough examples of where you do get that loyalty from the player. Even when they don't have a sort of natural link to a club, that link develops. And, you know, somebody from Argentina isn't going to know that much about Crystal Palace as a club until they're there. But that bond can grow and can strengthen it and can become as strong as a bond would be from a local player. You know, you look at someone like Wilf Zaha now, obviously he's got that bond as being somebody from the area. So he's always had that strong feeling towards Crystal Palace. But players from the other side of the world can grow a similar feeling if they're part of the fabric of the club and become part of it. And I think, especially with him as well, because he sort of fought his way in and out of the team a few times. You know, he had to budge Karai. He then had to see off various others like Hennessy, I think, Alex McCarthy and others at various points. So I think that helps him become a fan favourite. You know, they can see the effort he's putting in. It would be easy to quit at various stages and just say, well, I've had enough of this. I could easily get in a team somewhere else, whether that's lower down, whether that's another country, whatever. But to have the determination to stay and fight for it and to work your way back and to then prove yourself again and again and again, that's the kind of thing that cult heroes are made of. And I think that's where we're coming from here. So it's the loyalty that's been shown both ways, but also the sort of fight that, I guess, the bond that he'll have forged with the club, despite being from so far away and despite having no natural links to it, sticking with them through hard times as well, it hasn't all been on the up. Therefore, these are the kind of things that cult heroes are made of. They're the type of characters that the fans love to identify with and love to see playing for their club, even if you could say, well, some other goalkeeper is better. Obviously, I think Nigel Martin, you're right in saying it's probably a better goalkeeper. But when it comes to the connection, Speroni might beat him in that respect.
Yeah,
I think goalkeepers have this dilemma, don't they? A goalkeeper like Speroni would have a dilemma of, do they stay number one at Crystal Palace in the Championship, or do they go to Chelsea and be number two and get the occasional League Cup match or whatnot? And I think Speroni must have had them offers. He must have had them. And yet he remained, and that, as you said, Aidan, that's why he within the hearts of the Palace fans.
There's lots of, I guess there's lots of sort of criteria that, you know, boxes to tick when we talk about players who have been selected. You know, this guy's got, you know, longevity. He's got stickability. He bounced up and down a couple of times, keep fighting back, seemed to have a kinship with the club. And all those boxes, this guy seemed to tick. And he was a decent goalkeeper as well.
Yeah, he was.
Yeah. So we're going to put Julian Speroni then as our first chiselled effigy onto the Mount Rushmore above Crystal.
We do need an honourable mention, Gary, for Gabor Kerai's tracksuit trousers.
Well, yeah, the problem is, I need to sort of from the shoulders upwards, so the tracksuit trousers wouldn't have counted. So, I mean, his key characteristic would have been lost there, and I mean...
They were. I was going to say that they were so distracting when watching him that, you know, you've no idea whether he's a good goalie or not. Yeah. You're just staring at the trousers.
Was that the same pair all the way through his career? I think it might have been. You know, I think it might have been. I think it might have. I did hear somewhere. Maybe I'm just.
And did he have to supply them himself and therefore wash them himself?
Yeah, the only other goalkeeper I can remember who wore tracksuit bottoms on every game was a. Guy who used to play for Chelsea called Dmitry Kalarin, a Russian goalkeeper, played for Chelsea. I mean, he's gone back quite a while now. But he will tracksuit bottom all the time, and he won't great either. So
yeah.
I mean, if you're thinking about wearing tracksuit bottoms as a goalkeeper, guys, that's the idea. Stay with shorts. let's move out to the penalty area. We're going to look at defenders now. So before we go, give us your choice, David, let's have the runners-ups.
The near misses, the first one is Jim Cannon. Jim Cannon is the word stalwart himself. He was a record appearance holder, 571 games between 1973 and 88. I mean, he was always there. When I was a kid, he was always there, Jim Cannon. He had this kind of shoulder-length blonde hair with his sort of Mexican bandit moustache. I didn't realise he was Glaswegian. I didn't realise he was Scottish until he'd way into his playing career. And it just goes to show, he never represented Scotland at any level. It just goes to show how good the Scottish team was of the time. What was that, in the late 70s, early 80s? And he was just a good, solid central defender.
You mentioned he didn't know he was Scottish. He played like he was Scottish.
He did play. Now looking, when I looked at it now, I can say, yeah, he was Scottish. But at the time, I didn't get, because in them days, of course, it wasn't even that long ago. There was no interviews with a player or anything. You should assume that's what they were. Sure. And the next one is Terry Fenwick.
Terry Fenwick,
a blast from the past. He was more, but Terry was a part of the FA Cup winning youth team. I should know this. I think it was 77, 78, and 78, 79. We won. Don't quote me on that, but we won the FA Cup twice in a row, and Terry was an integral part of the team. He came from the north of England. He came from up Durham way somewhere. And why he ended up at Palace, I don't know. But he was there. And he was a part of the Terry Venables team of the 80s. And I think he was more notable for his time at QPR and Tottenham. Probably Tottenham more so than QPR. Yeah. And he was one of the guys Maradona dribbled past in the 86 World Cup in that goal. And also, I'm not sure. I remember him smacking... Diego Maradona upside the head with an elbow, I think.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure if that was before the goal or after.
Yeah, I think that'll have been the first half. Yeah. David, I think he was lucky to make it to half time, frankly. I think he could have been sent off more than once in the first half. And I think Fenwick himself cited the booking that he managed to get, despite possibly earning himself more than that. He cited the booking as a reason why he didn't chop Maradona down on that run. But frankly, he probably wouldn't have got up to him anyway. I mean, I guess he was one of those who was closer to challenging him, wasn't he? And he kind of put an arm out towards him and then let him go. So, yes, if Fenwick was happy to take a red card for England, that goal may never have happened.
I bet he's got. He didn't go on that shirt, though, eh? At the end of it. I bet Maradona wouldn't give it to him after that elbow.
Yes.
Steve Hodge didn't get near him, didn't kick him, so therefore he gave him the shirt.
A few years ago, I was on TalkSport with Alvin Martin, and Paul Coyte were doing a thing about the World Cup programme, and they were talking to that Steve Hodge on the phone, and he said about Maradona's shirt. He got married, and he said, "I don't know what it's worth. I mean, this is going back This was after my England book was publicised, going back, I don't know, 4 years or so now. No, much longer than that, because I've been here 4 years, so probably 5 or 6 years. But I'll tell you what, that didn't that shit pay off in the end?
Yeah, £7 million. Who bought it? Do we know?
I don't know. I don't know. It wasn't me.
No. Well, you would say that, Gary.
I don't think it was Peter Shilton either, to be honest with you. So,
yeah.
Fenwick, I guess he's one of these players that, did well for Crystal Palace, but probably might have been his better years at Tottenham. So, it's always sort of difficult, players like that, do some players, when they move on to bigger clubs, fans of their club. I'll give you an example. Like either Hazard went to Real Madrid. No, Chelsea fan resented that. I mean, because it was fine, it's understandable. And yet when Courtois went to Real Madrid, he was sort of given a lot of hate mail because of the things he'd said before. And I think it's a lot of it to do with when players move on, their attitude to the club they're leaving. I can't remember Fenwick being particularly controversial. It was just the way of the world, I suppose, at that time. Who's next then, David?
Just a notable mention for Gary Cahill, who we got from the Chelsea guys. I mean, I wouldn't say he's a Palace legend. He's probably leave that to the Bolton Wanderers guy you're going to get on here at one time. But he was just a fantastic player. He was just a good. You could tell he'd spent the bulk of his career at playing the Champions League and for England. He was just a good player, good professional, good player. I still like watching. I know most people don't care much for watching central defenders, but I quite enjoyed watching Gary Cahill.
Yeah, he's great. He played exceptionally well for us, and as you say, played in the continent's top competitions, over and over again. And how long was it with the Palace? Couple of years?
2 years, I think. Yeah.
But I mean, when players like that move to the club, it's only their ability to take their experience and organisational ability as well. So yeah, I mean, yeah. Is there anybody else you got, David, before we get to your choice?
No, that's it. And then we're on to the main man himself.
Okay. So what about those choices, that Aidan? Anybody you sort of promote there? Any ex Newcastle players that you want to put? Let's say Fenwick's from Durham. That's pretty close. I mean,
yes, he is a northeasterner, but no, I don't think he was quite as classy as the person that David has picked. Although. He had his attributes. The other ones that kind of spring to mind, I endorse everything he said about Gary Cahill and so on in terms of his class. Obviously, Gareth Southgate had a bit of a spell, but I think Villa would be where he had longer, so it would be more thought of in terms of there. And more recent one, I wonder whether he has a certain cult appeal, is Milivojevic, given the sort of crucial penalties he always gets and things like that. I don't know whether he's anyone who comes into reckoning, but maybe that's just too recent and too modern. But no, I don't think any of them are going to hold a candle to the one that David has picked.
Yeah, the man himself, Kenny Sansom.
Wow.
What a player. Really, what a player. I mean, he's Crystal Palace through and through, local South London boy, part of the 1977-78 FA Cup youth team. This guy's a left back. He's a left back, and he's the best player on the team. He's got Vince Allaire in it, Peter Nicholas, who Arsenal and was he Chelsea? He was, wasn't
yes,
he?
Chelsea, yeah.
Arsenal, Chelsea, and Wales. Terry Fenwick was in it, of course, and he was just a very good player. I mean, he was another player who left the Palace, which we didn't begrudge him, and went to Arsenal. And he's 86 times for England he played. I think only surpasses England's greatest ever left back by Ashley Cole.
Yeah, I'd agree with that, and I think it was close something there.
I think so. But he was just a very. I mean, he was an excellent cross on the ball. He was just powerful, great control, handsome, sensum. He's had his issues since though, which hopefully he'll. I mean, he's been recently a very low ebb with all sorts of problems with drugs and drink and. Gambling addictions and whatnot, but when you guys know you come into money, Aidan, you probably can afford him. Gary, now of course you've swapped over, you two, haven't you? Hey, you'll be Gary, Aidan, you'll be lending Gary money now. I say, when one of you buys Tyrick Mitchell, probably Aidan buys Tyrick Mitchell, we'll get Kenny back. So we need him back on his feet again.
Yeah, oh, yeah. I mean, you wanted to mention about. Fate after football, and it's a cautionary tale for so many players could fall off the sort of pedestal afterwards, and it's sad when people sensationalise it and make money out of it, and
Yeah, well, you're referring to the pictures in the paper, Gary.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's disgusting. I mean, how? I mean, it's bad enough someone actually taking a picture of someone collapsed in a park, yeah, knowing who they are, then taking that picture and selling it or offering to sell it to a publisher and a news agency, and that news agency actually paying for it. I mean, yeah. I don't get me wrong. I always thought news was like there to inform. Yeah. What's that? You know,
it's the very essence of the gutter press, David. And
yeah.
Unfortunately, people. Yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, the reason newspapers paid money for that sort of thing is because people read it. And people didn't read their paper; they wouldn't do it.
I haven't bought that paper since, Norfolk. I haven't bought it since. One man campaign.
Yeah, good for you, mate. I mean, it is terrible. You know, you wish players like that, you know, all the best. I mean, you get this sort of celebrated situation like Gascoigne, obviously. But you know, it's Paul Merson had a sort of similar situation as well, and it's tragic. And I think it's easy to forget that footballers are just people at the end of the day. Yeah, no, they're not gods. They're just people. They've got the same weaknesses that, you know, just been the Rinder Clear and the Baker have got as well. So let's sort of go back to his playing days, because Kenny Sanson, as you're saying, along with Ashley Cole, and I think it's a close decision as to who has been the best left back over 50, 60, 70, 80, 90 years. Aidan, what do you think? Kenny Sanson?
Yeah, fabulous player. He's another one who made it to Newcastle as well. There's another connection. But that was
much towards, there, yeah.
He was. That was towards the end of his career. So that was past his prime. Obviously, Arsenal was where he was in his prime. But he was a Crystal Palace development, a Crystal Palace creation, if you like. You know, he part of the youth setup, as David said. Played for them in three divisions, I think, third, second, and first, following a teenage breakthrough into the team. Now, you know, that says a lot about a player, I think, because a club rising through those divisions, you think, well, much of the squad may rise too, but I think many of them would fall by the wayside as that progression is happening for the club. It's not everyone can cope with that raising of standards or repeated raising of standards that climbing through three divisions will give you. But to not only cope with it, but to flourish in it and thrive in it, I think says an awful lot about somebody who was obviously still very young at this stage. As you say, yeah, definitely one of the best left backs for England. Ashley Cole, probably recency bias makes people sway towards that as well. I mean, he played for England as their number one choice left back through most of the 1980s, I guess, until the emergence of Stuart Pearce towards the end of the decade. When Sanson was sort of towards the tail end of his career. So, you know, he was a mainstay of the team throughout an awful lot of that decade. But yes, in terms of Crystal Palace, it's a shame, I guess, in some ways that the players that you brought through or nurtured then ultimately move on. But I think there's a pride too in that, in having developed them, having brought them through. You know, I guess it's one of the realities of a club of the level of Crystal Palace that there will generally be other clubs that are bigger and can offer greater rewards and greater opportunity to those who are the elite, which is what we're talking about here with Kenny Sanson. It's an unfortunate reality, I suppose. But yes, you still get that pride of what the player has gone on to achieve, having been brought through by Crystal Palace, having been developed by Crystal Palace. You know, he went on to big things for his club and for his country, but he is a Crystal Palace creation. Therefore, you know, I think that's where you have that sort of fixed bond from that. You know, he'll always have that in his background. He'll always be the teenager who was captain of a youth FA Cup youth winning team, captain of the England youth team whilst playing for Palace, and like I say, coming through three divisions and flourishing in that environment. That's something that Crystal Palace and Kenny Sanson will always be connected by, and I think that's where the pride comes from there.
Sorry, I think anybody with any sort of vintage of football experience would have been staggered if Kenny Sanson had been picked. I mean, some of these choices, I mean, over this sort of episode, we've done some of the sort of standout obvious ones, and you know, others are a little bit more sort of personal, shall we say, personal selections, and you know, massive agreement with Kenny Sanson. So definitely he's the defender up on there. And moving to midfield, I guess this wasn't an obvious one. So let's look at who came close, David, in midfield.
We've got the near misses. The first one is Jeff Thomas. I mean, this is a guy. Yeah. He wasn't spectacular. He was very competent. He was a linchpin of the 91 team. I think he came from Dario Gradi's crew. I know he came from Dario Gradi's crew. And Graham Taylor sent him for England, which is no surprise, really. He was very much a Graham Taylor kind of player. Yeah. And my mate, who doesn't really follow football, I met Jeff Thomas, funny enough, we're name-dropping here, Gary, having a competition. I met him at Talk Sport.
Ah, there we go. I should have seen you there.
And, I was chatting to him, and afterwards I happened to meet my mate that afternoon. I said to him, I met Jeff Thomas. He said, did you ask about that miss? I said, what miss was that? He said, that miss for England. Do you know it? Do you remember it? I didn't remember it at all.
Against France.
My mate doesn't even watch football. He said, I looked on YouTube, and that was some miss.
Yeah.
It's something I remember just merely from the same reason you're talking about, David, of it being mentioned so often. That you look it up and you see it, and yes, it's sliced towards the corner flag, wasn't it?
Yeah, he tried to keep the goalkeeper, didn't he? And it came up the side of his foot, and as you say, I didn't have to hit the corner flag, but it was heading in that sort of direction.
Yeah. Now, but he was another terrific player, and you're right there, definitely a typical Graham Taylor player. But to give him another shout out, he's obviously someone who hit his own hard times health wise in later life, and the work he's done. In terms of, I think he's done all sorts of huge cycling trips and so on for raising money as well. So he's used his profile, you like, to raise all sorts of funds and to make great awareness of various issues. So that's a big shout out to him for that as well.
And he's a lovely fellow too.
Real. And despite that miss, more decent player, he turned out to be a more decent bloke afterwards as well.
Yeah, he's a lovely fellow. They don't meet your heroes, but not in Jeff Thomas's case. He was a lovely fellow. He's a really nice guy. The second one, Aidan mentioned before, Gareth Southgate. I think when he was at the Palace, Southgate played in midfield.
Yeah,
he wasn't. I can't remember him there. I know he was there, but he's one of them players that you just can't remember. And it's probably why he's England manager now. He's very conformative, very, you know, he'd be head boy, wouldn't he? Oh, Gareth Southgate, he'd be head boy. But I mean, I think he'd done better. Did he go Villa Borough or Borough Villa? He went Villa Borough, didn't he? Villa Borough, and I think he's done his best at Villa. But I mean, he's worthy of a mention, so I don't know what he's up to these days, but he's apparently doing all right for himself. and a third one, you'll know this guy, Gary, Steve Kemba.
Steve Kemba.
You'll know him, of course, but I'm saying for Gary, because he played for Chelsea for a bit. I want to give him Steve a mention because he was a local Croydon boy. He had a bar in Croydon called Kemba's, which was a bit of a hangout.
I remember a game, I can't remember who we were playing against. And it was a goalman scramble, and the referee gave a goal. And Steve Kemba said to the referee, it didn't go over the line, ref. And the referee cancelled the goal out. Obviously, we're talking a long, long time ago here, but what a decent player he was, Stevie Kemba.
Steve Kemba scored the goal.
No, I don't remember. He might have, but I can't remember. It was a bit of a goalman scramble. And I said, the referee thought the ball had gone over the line, or the line, though, I can't remember. And Kemba went to the referee and said, it didn't go over the line.
Yeah.
So, honest guy as well, clearly. I'm not sure what his teammates thought about that afterwards, but you know, there you go. So, it can be, yeah.
And then the next one is Miles Jednarik. He was like an Aussie version of Jeff Thomas. Really, he was bulkier than Jeff Thomas. Really strong, really very good with his... very good passing, well, not long passing, but I always used to watch him and always impressed by how his short passing. Never seemed to me to make a mistake. And he was very dependable, and he was captain of the Australian team at the 2014 World Cup. Which for us then,
David,
he did have a big beard.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah.
Which, a Palace to even have one player at the World Cup was quite big, but then to have a player as a captain of the Aussie team, and the Socceroos aren't bad. I mean, Australian football players in general, we had Viduka, Craig Johnson.
Yeah.
Over the years, and yeah. I don't think he was in the class of Craig Johnston. Or who was he? Harry Kew, another great player, another Aussie player. Yeah. Who was the Italian Aussie? Oh, the one who played for the Italian national team.
Yeah, it's Christian Vieri. He was born in Melbourne.
Yeah.
And he spoke English with his thick Australian accent.
Yeah, I remember being interviewed.
Which is utterly, utterly weird to hear, isn't it? Yeah. You just don't expect an Italian striker to be like that. But yeah, he's a Melbourne boy.
Yeah.
And Johan Cabaye, who was just a great player. I mean, truly, truly class player. He came to us in 2015 from Paris Saint-Germain, the Paris Saint-Germain of then, not now. But before that, he'd been at Newcastle United. And I think you guys got the best of him, Aidan. But when he came down to us, I mean, he was just class. He was a French international. I mean, was he in the World Cup squad? He must have been.
Oh, must have been.
Oh, he was certainly in Euro 2012, I think it was, which is around the time where he just joined Newcastle, I think. And so he may have been in the World Cup following that as well. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Absolute class player.
Yeah, fantastic.
I mean, obviously, I see him in a certain shade of stripes rather than red and blue when I think of Cabaye. So, yes, I'm glad you haven't picked him in the end. that would have been a bit odd.
No.
But he was absolute class, sheer class. Everything he did just smacked of quality. There was no physical presence to him whatsoever. But he's one of those players who just had that calmness, composure, and elegance, if you like, on the ball. Mm. Brilliant, brilliant player.
Go on, David. Anybody else got your list before we go to your main?
That's it. Okay. That's a near missing.
I just took a couple of names at you then that I was sort of came to my mind when I was thinking this morning about what we're going to discuss tonight. Vince Hilaire. You mentioned him earlier.
Vince Hilaire, yeah, I thought he was more of a winger. But he was. I mean, Vince Hilaire, I think he done must as well at Portsmouth. When you get your Pompey man on, he'll tell you. But I think he done well at Portsmouth. And I remember I was chatting to a guy, a Waterlooville fan. And he said to me, oh, Vince Hilaire was our best player. And he was knocking on his mid-30s and he was still the best player in that team.
Yeah.
He was just a good.
I always picture Vince Hilaire with that sort of that white kit with the sash. Venables, his team of the seem to be on the cusp, but not quite actually getting there.
Yeah, I know.
And the other one I was going to mention is Peter Taylor.
Yeah, Peter Taylor. He was very very good player. I think he'd done better away from us. Gary, I think he'd done better at Tottenham. Did he move to Tottenham from us?
Yes, he did.
But he was very strong, very direct. I think he became more famous for being the England manager who gave Beckham his debut, no?
Correct, yeah.
But he was. Peter Taylor was very much a... He came from Essex, I think, down at the Palace. I don't know how he arrived at us. But a bit before my time.
Yeah, unfortunately not before mine.
Yeah.
Thoughts on those items? Anybody want to add before we ask David to tell us who's going to accompany Speroni and Kenny Sansom on the Mount Rushmore?
Oh, I haven't got any others to offer there, Gary. I think we've covered a lot. But I will say I'm very much looking forward to talking about this next guy.
So come on, David. Tell us who's...
Oh, here he is, the man himself, the bald eagle. It's Attilio Lombardo.
Wow.
What a player, honestly. Honestly, when he came to Palace, it was like Cindy Crawford walking into a British Legion. It really was. What's he doing here? I mean, he came to us in 2010. It was mad. It was like, it was just a mad time. It was 2010. We was going to administration. I think that Ron Rhodes had sold it to Mark Goldberg, who had... It all went belly up. I can't remember the ins and outs of it, but Simon Jordan ended up buying it from Mark Goldberg. And in between, we had Thomas Brolin turn up with Attilio Lombardo. Now, Brolin wasn't the Brolin of the... Well, I can't remember what World Cup that would have been. Would that have been the 2004 World Cup? No. Anyway, but he wasn't the Brolin then. He put a bit of weight on that.
Oh, it's 94, you mean? 94 was when Sweden got to the semi-finals, yeah. Wasn't it? He was the star then. Obviously, Euro 92 as well. But prior to that. But yes, he lost his way a little bit by the time he reached Palace.
He acted as Attilio's translator. And I used to watch that programme was on Channel 4.
Football Italia.
What's it called? Yeah, I used to watch that. So I knew who Lombardo was. And he was just a great player. I used to love watching him on the telly. And Juventus player. I don't know what issues he had at Juventus that he ended up coming to Palace, but he did. And we're glad for it. But, I mean, it was sort of a time when a lot of top Italian players were coming to England. You had your team there. We had Vialli and Zola at Chelsea. Yeah, yeah. We had Ravanelli went to Derby, didn't he? Yeah. And Di Canio at West Ham. And we got Lombardo. And only 50 appearances he made there, but he's still by far the best player I've ever seen at Crystal Palace. He played on the right. He was very... You know these guys, when they get the ball, They just seem to know what they're going to do before they get it. They just know. They're never flustered.
Yeah.
They get it, and even when they're surrounded, they don't look concerned about it.
Yeah. It's interesting. Yes, I mean, you know, there's players that, you know, when you're watching a game, you want some players to get the ball because you think there's something's going to happen from there. They're going to create something. They've got that's I don't know, that X factor that you know, us mere mortals can't even contemplate sometimes. But a maverick player, Aidan, what do you think about Attilio Lombardo and the possibility of him turning up at Crystal Palace after playing? I haven't played a number of top Italian clubs as well.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, he's someone, as David says, we know well from the Football Italia and Gazzetta and so on, programmes on Channel 4. You know, he was synonymous with a great Sampdoria side of the early 90s, yeah, and then obviously progressed on from there. But a fabulous player, fabulously skillful, as David said. You know, such pace, such quality, the ability to look like you've got all the time in the world, or you just know what is going to happen around you without having to do anything, seemingly. You know, what's going to happen next. You can judge where every player is going to move, where the ball is going to go. You know, he's one of those players who just had that. But as David alluded to there, it was a crazy time. Now, this is obviously an era where the Premier League was a very different place to what it is now in terms of spending power and attraction for the top stars across Europe. You know, that wasn't the case in the sort of late 90s. Sure, there'd been various international stars who'd come. Bergkamp had been around for a few years, or a year or two before this happened. You mentioned the players at Chelsea and so on. Obviously, Ravanelli, he was at Borough first, then Derby. But, you know, the people like that pitching up at these kind of clubs, it was bizarre. It was such a strange time. And Lombardo fitted that as well. And, you know, he and Brolin, of course, they kind of summed up what seemed a bit of a crazy period of time for an outsider looking in on Crystal Palace there. It seemed all just gloriously fun, but slightly insane as well. You know, it's as though the sort of lunatics had taken over the asylum to some extent. It's just how it seemed. And obviously when he then became the manager,
well, yeah,
that fitted the narrative perfectly of what on earth is going on here. It's just gloriously fun. But what an incredible coup for a club like Crystal Palace. I mean, it's a coup for the Premier League, straight up. But, you know, that no matter what club he'd gone to, this would have been a coup for the Premier League. But for him to ship up at Crystal Palace is fabulous for that club. And it's easy to see why the fans would fall in love with him so well. Yeah. You know, he was such quality. And he stayed following relegation as well, which, again, that's another factor that leads to the appeal. Then the financial situation and the mess meant he probably had to be sold off for financial reasons and so on. He left for Lazio there. But I think the other aspect of this is he only played 49 times for Crystal Palace. Now, to have wound your way and twined yourself in everyone's consciousness so much for such a short space of time,
yeah,
that says so much about the impact that he had, about his ability and how he stood out, not just in Crystal Palace terms, but in Premier League terms, in terms of his ability and quality. You know, he was also voted into Crystal Palace's centenary 11. And to do so, again, having been there for such a short space of time, is remarkable. But, you know, that's testament to how good he was. But it was just the perfect encapsulation of a crazy, crazy time, that everything seemed to be just up in the air at Crystal Palace. And you know, he wasn't quite as off the wall as Brolin. But, you know, they seemed to come as a pair, yeah, to some extent. As David said, Brolin translating for him. But it was madcap fun. And it was wildly entertaining. So that's me as somebody from looking on the outside in. And I was wildly entertained by it. So, you know, the Crystal Palace fans must have been loving every single minute of it.
It's interesting. I think I was thinking back when I saw David's choices. I think there's only one other player been selected who actually also became manager of the club. And that was Billy McNeil. But even he didn't do it while he was playing at the same time as well. And, you know, Crystal Palace fans were surprised and, you know, delightedly surprised when until Lombardo signed for Crystal Palace as a player, if anybody had said, this guy's going to be a manager in a while as well, I mean, you know, I mean, talk about layers of sort of sensationalism. I guess he's one of these players, David, that people sort of rejoice in watching, isn't he?
Yeah, I think he's one of them players that you make the most of it. You know there's something special.
Yeah.
So you make sure you get there and you don't miss a match because you know he's either going to go or he's not going to be there long. So it's kind of, he was one of them. They're few and far between, but when they are, they've all had them at their clubs. Gascoigne at yours, yeah. Aidan, I think. Yeah. And Chelsea have had their share. But
yeah, exactly. It's the flamboyance and the flair, yeah. Isn't it? And it's just, you know, this is so different in terms of the appeal to other things we talked about, like loyalty the pride in a youth product, as we talked about with Spironi and Sanson. Quality as well, obviously, but this is a totally different type of quality. This is somebody who can do what you could never even imagine. It's someone who can do the impossible on a football field that is so far beyond the ordinary. You know, yeah, Sanson, obviously, we've talked about him as being one of the best fullbacks in England's history, but the stuff he's doing on the ball isn't something that's so otherworldly that it is with somebody like Lombardo, perhaps. Not to say he's quite in Messi's class or anything like that, but, you know, there's something about doing skillful things with pace and directness that it excites everybody. Yeah. It gets the crowd going. It gets people off the edge of their seat. It gets you shouting and cheering. And it's the kind of person who, as soon as they get the ball, the noise level rises automatically just with the anticipation of what might happen. And it may not always, and, you know, you might run down a dead end or get splattered by some forceful fullback of the other team. But something is going to happen. And he's going to get into this situation several times in a game and on several occasions, something very positive will happen.
Yeah.
And it's that quality that is well worth the price of admission. And that's what draws people in, and it appeals so much on a sort of base entertainment level because it's so far beyond what everyone else on the pitch can do.
Guys, who was the first Italian guy to come here? I mean, out of the Zola, Viala, Vialli.
Probably Vialli, I would say, in terms of these high-profile ones. I think Gary would probably be slightly before the others at that time. Obviously, Chelsea had Hummels.
I mean, Hummels came from Italy. He wasn't Italian, obviously, but he probably came from Italy. Yeah. So perhaps, I mean, if you count players from came from Italy, probably Hummels would be the first one, I would guess. Chelsea.
Well, Bergkamp obviously arrived from Italy as well, I guess around similar mid-90s, but maybe Hullet predates him slightly
I think so.
But in terms of actual Italians, yeah, I think Vialli was probably the first high-profile Italian player. Lombardo a little bit after, but, you know, it was just the insane entertainment of it all. It was marvellous.
Yeah. Well, that entertainment value has earned him a place on Crystal Palace, much more so. There he's going to be, there he goes. And I'm quite sort of pleased he's gone there because a while ago I had to do Henrik Larsson and perishing breadlogs with my chisel. I broke two chisels doing that. So fortunately, being politically challenged, he's not going to cause so much trouble. So, right, let's move to the sharp end of the pitch then now and talk about the forwards. That usual procedure, David. So tell us who came close.
Okay. Here we go, the ones that come close. As you mentioned, Peter Taylor, Vince Hilaire. And the other one is Andy Johnson. We got from Birmingham City when Trevor Francis was manager. And seeing as Trevor Francis was a Birmingham legend, I do believe he's on the Mount Rushmore Birmingham City wall.
Yes.
Is he not?
I think so, yes.
That he took from them their best player. So, I think he scored a hat-trick against Brighton on his debut for the Palace, which is leading to us knowing. But he's only 5'9". He wasn't a big guy, Andy Johnson, and he was on the fringe of the England team, and he was a formidable finisher. He rarely missed. He rarely blasted the ball without thinking. He was precise in his finishing. Instinctive, yeah. And he also looked a bit like a hard Jimmy Somerville, which is a look we've all gone for at some time, I'm sure. He was overshadowed for the England team. I can't think who kept him out of the England team now.
He did play a few times, didn't he?
He did play a few times, perhaps. And he went on to Fulham, didn't he?
Yeah.
He done well there.
Yeah. Yeah, so honourable mention for Andy Johnson, AJ, as he was known, yeah.
And the next one I've got here is Victor Moses, who another player who fared better away from the Palace, but he was a local boy. I know he's born in Nigeria, but he grew up in South Norwood. He left us to go to Wigan Athletic, and then from then on, I mean, he's in his early 30s now. Last time I saw, he was playing for Spartak Moscow, but I mean, he's been at Chelsea, Liverpool, Inter Milan. I think he's one of them players who's always... he's a squad player, isn't he, Victor Moses?
Well, when he came to Chelsea, he played as a winger, and then when Conte came and played as a five, well, back three wing-backs, he excelled as a wing-back, and he played almost the entire championship season under Conte. He was played really well, but he did go to... was it Zenit he went to, I think? Zenit St. Petersburg or Moscow? I can't remember. He went to a Russian club, I know. But a checkered career, sort of, you know. Ups and downs. But as I say, when he was at Chelsea, that's that one season. I suppose he was there for a season and a half, really. But exceptionally, he was an automatic selection as the wing-back.
I mean, he was a great player at the Palace. I was surprised he went to Wigan Athletic, because I think Wigan was in the Championship. And Wigan must have been in the Premiership by then.
Yeah.
And I mean, and the next one, guys, is Wilf Zaha.
Zaha.
He's 12 years ago made his debut. Another local boy, a Fulton East boy. He came onto the scene for the Palace, and he sort of burst onto the scene. And then he went to Manchester United. He was Alex Ferguson's last signing. But David Moyes, as we all know, replaced Alex Ferguson. Just didn't fancy him. I'm not sure the ins and outs why, but he didn't fancy him. Wilf returned to the Palace, signed quite a lengthy contract, which we've adhered him to since. And apart from interest from clubs who kind of, Tottenham were interested for a while, it was said that Paris Saint-Germain were interested for a while. We've never sold him simply because we couldn't see the point of selling him, because the amount of money we get for selling him, we don't have to buy someone else, and we've got him. And I'm not sure if it's too late for a move now. And it's quite interesting. I'm interested in your opinion, fellas, whether Wilf Zaha has found his level at the Palace, or he would have been going to a bigger club. Chelsea, maybe.
I mean, I don't know if he's found his level, but he's found a club where he's comfortable and he's competent to perform at.
But was he though, Gary, under Roy Hodgson? Was he comfortable? He's comfortable under Vieira.
Yeah.
Or Roy Hodgson was.
Yeah, like... I mean, you know, it's a bit of Matthew Letizia to me. I mean, on the football pitch, not the idiot he's turned into afterwards. He was sort of, he could be the big guy. I wouldn't say it's a small club, but not at the top six club. I think it suited him. But Palace were sort of, I was at the player, didn't they build a team around him, but he was the big guy in that team.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I think when he went to, if he'd gone to another club, he'd be just one of the other big guys that are already there. I mean, I don't know, but it's one chance, of him making it to Manchester United. And there was always rumours about personal differences with David Moyes, and these things happen sometimes. And
I think it's a lot about timing. You know, I think he's got, you know, bags and bags of ability, but I think potentially he moved too soon to the big club, if we're going to use that term, at Manchester United. I think it makes you wonder whether he moved a year or two later, whether it would have turned out differently for him. You know, just with that extra couple of years development in, as Gary's saying there, the sort of safe home environment, you know, somewhere he feels comfortable, somewhere he felt able to thrive. If he'd had a little bit more time there, would he have managed to step up better? Possibly, I don't know. But as Gary says, I doubt now that he'll get that move again, because, you know, history may look back at it, you know, when we look back on his career in years to come, you could either think he moved too young and it was too soon for him, or the sort of negative way of looking at it would be that he couldn't cope with that step up. And I think that's a little bit unfair. But I think that's entirely down to the timing of it and the circumstance. And obviously, yes, he's come back to Crystal Palace and thrived again. He's a terrific player. But Yeah, I think the ship has sailed now when it comes to a bigger move, which is all to Palace's game, because, you know, he's a terrific player. He obviously loves the club, has great affinity for it, and really, really enjoys playing for Crystal Palace. So that's all to the benefit for Crystal Palace. But I think, yeah, when it comes to the move to a bigger club, I think timing has an awful lot to do with it. And potentially it was too soon. And therefore, that's ended up as being a little mark against him in some people's minds. Whereas, really, if he'd been allowed a little more time to develop, maybe it would have worked better.
I think it was also perhaps the wrong club at the wrong time as well, with, you know, Ferguson being just leaving and Moyes coming in, and Man United were in sort of a transition. So, I mean, there's lots of reasons why it perhaps didn't work out. But I think, you know, he's one of those enigma players, isn't he? That, you know, you always think, oh, could he have been better? Could he have been better at a bigger club, in inverted commas? I mean, who can say? But I don't think many Palace fans would think Zaha could hold a candle to the guy you've chosen, though, David, anyway. So,
yeah, no. This is the man himself, the number one. Let's tell. We all know it's going to be Ian Wright. What a player. And a fantastic guy. He came to us. Steve Coppell bought him. This has been 88, 89. And I used to keep a sort of lazy eye on South London non-league football. I mean, I know where the teams are. Tooting and Mitcham, Sutton United. We've got Dulwich Hamlet, Fisher Athletic. And he came from Greenwich Borough, I'd never heard of. And I've got to tell you guys, my dear old dad, he was a bus driver. And he had a mate who worked with him called Ian Wright. And this guy was he's one of these guys who compensated for having a bald head by having a great big bloody beard, you know. And you could picture him being a member of like the Real Ale Society, and he was a drinker, and he got sacked from the buses for drink driving, and he went on to work for British Rail afterwards. He was driving the bus when the police nicked him, and so this is how I pictured Ian Wright. And the kid that turned up was basically, I'm not being derogatory to Wrighty, but he was like this black kid who was like a street kid, you know. He had. He had the attitude about him. He was unschooled. He was uncoached. He was like a park football player, and yet he was by far and away the best player on the pitch. As soon as he started, as soon as he made his debut, you thought, wow, who is this kid? And a lot of these players who come through the professional system have been coached out of them, the petulance and the sort of unnecessary aggression. But don't forget, Wrighty now is a national treasure, and we all sort of love him and watch him on the daytime TV or what, this, that and the other. But then he wasn't long out of prison then. I mean, I don't know what he was in for, but he wasn't long out of prison. And Vardy reminds me of him, Jamie Vardy, the way he played off the shoulder. And when he was one-on-one, Wrighty knew he would score, we knew he would score, and the opposition goalkeeper knew he would score. He was just fantastic. And he was a part of the infamous, 9-0. And then, as we know, in the FA Cup final of the same year, he scored twice.
Yeah.
To was it 3-3, I think it was, yeah, against Manchester,
yeah,
United.
Yeah.
And then he moved on to Arsenal, and which we never really begrudged him. And there's Arsenal. But funny enough, with Ian Wright, this is quite interesting. I'm curious of your opinion on this, guys. Is he never really made it for England? He never played at a major tournament. No. I mean, he was probably overshadowed or eclipsed, as you say, by Alan Shearer. We had Robbie Fowler, Les Ferdinand. He was overlooked by Graham Taylor, which probably wasn't surprising, really, considering the way Graham Taylor played football. But Terry Venables never picked him, and nor did Hoddle didn't seem to rate him either. And he never played at a major tournament, Ian Wright. I'm just curious as to...
Yeah, it's interesting.
Why you guys think that would be?
Yeah, I remember the 3-3 cup final thing. I don't know which goal it was, it of the two he scored, but he's running down and his shirt looks 14 times too big for him. And he just looked like a street kid. It's a great description for him, yeah. For England, it's massive. I mean, I don't know any player who I've seen prouder to be an England player and give more than Ian Wright did for England. He was such a... that's what I'm looking for. It meant so much to him. It meant so much to him when he was playing for England. And, yeah, and it does seem unfair that he never really got a fair crack of the whip because of some of the players you mentioned. And I'm not saying, that they were players are better than him, but they were just preferred. And perhaps they were playing for, in inverted commas, bigger clubs at the time. But even when it was at Arsenal, he never really sort of had that run in the England team that a goal scorer of that calibre surely should have warranted. What do you think, Aidan?
Yeah, I think when it comes to England, Euro 92, he certainly should have gone. But as David said, Graham Taylor just didn't seem to rate him. You know, he was the top scorer that year in the first division, as it was then, but was overlooked. But, you know, at that time, that season, I don't think there was any finer English striker. You know, Shearer was still just coming through at that point and obviously would become the prime guy for much of the 90s or the later 90s. And Gary Lineker was very much at the end of his career. But Ian Wright was the form guy. He's the one who should have been, well, he certainly should have been in the squad. Whether he ended up in the starting lineup is another matter. If Lineker was obviously the tried and trusted at that point. But, you know, Alan Smith of Arsenal was part of that squad and got several games. You know, Ian Wright would have been somebody I'd rather have thrown on in that last group game when England needed a goal rather than Alan Smith. But maybe that's just me. It clearly wasn't Graham Taylor. I think later on in the 90s, yeah, obviously Shearer became the main man, understandably so, I think. But I think, you know, this was a kind of golden time for English strikers in sort of mid to late 90s. I think maybe I just would say Shearer was the main guy, but obviously successive English managers thought so as well. But, you know, if you think of the other players around this time, Robbie Fowler, Les Ferdinand, Andy Cole, I guess, and then Teddy Sheringham was one who came through as well. Yeah, you know, there's a lot of real quality. Yeah. England as a country was blessed at that time, I guess, with striking talent, and that's unfortunate for Ian Wright. However, I do think he should have had much more of a look in than he did. I think 1998 he would have gone to the World Cup, but he was injured just prior to it, or injured that year. He'd had a big impact the year before in that tournoi competition that England won in France. He'd been there. That's where Scholes had his big breakthrough internationally as well. And obviously Wright played fabulously well in the last qualifier against Italy as well, the goalless draw that saw England through. I think he would have been a fundamental part of that squad had he been fit for the finals that summer. So again, that's just incredible misfortune. But, you know, there's a big gap in between 1992, where I think he should have been in, and 1998, where I think he would have been in, where he wasn't really getting the look in that others were, which is really unfortunate. Because, I mean, what a great player he was. He was an absolute phenomenon. You know, you talk about the massive baggy shirt that he had on and racing around. You just see the bundle of energy, like a force of nature, charging around. You know, when he was on form, he was absolutely unstoppable, and the goals he scored were a huge variety. You know, he's not a sort of one trick pony of a striker, or not somebody along the ilk of, say, Thierry Henry in more recent years at Arsenal. In terms of the manner of his goals, you can see him running in from the left and side footing it into the far side of the goal. You know, you can see that in your mind's eye when you picture an Henry goal. But Ian Wright, they came in all sorts of shapes and form. So many ways, and obviously so often as well. He always seemed to find a way to score, whatever the situation. He was remarkable. You just knew there was something about him. You just knew he was going to score. And harking back to Crystal Palace, obviously 1990, I talked earlier about how that's where he sort of, him and Crystal Palace leapt into my consciousness. You know, he always seemed to come as a double act with Mark Bright. And that was probably how the commentators liked it, because the rhyming names and so on, you know, it kind of stuck in your mind, Wright and Bright. But he was... You know, he was the classier act of the two. Mark Bright was a good player, but he wasn't Ian Wright. And just seeing him come on, I mean, my God, how much we were all willing him to beat Manchester United, us neutrals as well. And I'm sure you were too. But it was fabulous when he came off the bench and scored within minutes and put Palace ahead, I think, as well. You know, but the way he's come through, and I think this is important. You talked there about where he'd come from and the issues he'd had as youth. But I think... The manner in which his career developed in the early stages, and you can see similarities to somebody more recently like Jamie Vardy, you know, who hadn't got discovered at the top level until later. But I think Ian Wright, it's more extreme. But I think the benefits of that is that he hasn't been schooled in the big club system. Now, today, that would be an academy. Back in those days, I guess, YTS or some such similar scheme. So he hasn't had his rough edges rounded. And I think for somebody like Ian Wright, when you talk about the sort of the attributes he brings to it, I think to have not had those rough edges smoothed out, to therefore still be raw and still just be, you know, playing a little bit on instinct, but just having the skills and the wherewithal and the nous to actually make that work at the top level. You know, that's a rare thing. Not many people are able to do that and get into the professional game at the age of 21. You know, it sounds very young, but to actually make it through to a professional contract, that's, you know, that's past it in terms of when you start. To be able to do that and to thrive shows something about him. But I think it was to his benefit, and obviously Crystal Palace's and Arsenal and England's in later days benefit, that he still had that roughness to him, that rawness. And I think that enhanced his game. It also, when we're talking here about fan appeal and sort of things you latch onto, that story, that rawness is something that fans adore. They love seeing that because you can see that in yourselves as well. You won't be able to do what he can do on the field, as we talked about with the others as well. But there's certain attributes that resonate and have a bit of familiarity. And I think people adore that sort of, I don't want to say rags to riches, that sounds a little patronizing. But, you know, the late breakthrough and the street kid, as you put it, who makes it through to the top against all the odds in coming through the manner he did. And I think the manner that he did it, though, enhanced him as a player.
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually. I mean, a lot of fans, you know, sort of take players to heart because they can see an identity that they can sort of not share, but sort of empathise with, and it becomes, you know, I hate that phrase, one of our own, but, you know, it's almost that sort of thing, isn't it? You can say, well, okay, well, you know, perhaps there's still a chance for me. I mean, you know, I'm mid-60s, but I don't give a bob yet. The boots are still on. So, you know, I'm waiting for the call. So, you know, Tommy T.
Go for it.
But, you know, I mean, yeah, and I think you're right. It's a really good point you made about it didn't come through the system. And, you know, I think him not coming through the system made him a better player and certainly a more engaging player as well because of that situation. I mean, do you think, David, there's an element of that in it?
Yeah, I think so. I think that I'm sure he would have been a great player, but maybe, you know what, guys, maybe he'd be even better player if he hadn't come through the system. Maybe he had been coached in that way. Maybe he would have been.
Perhaps, yeah.
But I can't help but think that the opposition, and even his own teammates, he kicked off with George Wood, the goalkeeper, with Jim Cannon. They fights in training and whatnot, so he must have been quite something in respect to how the pecking order. He had no time for the pecking order. He had no time for being told what to do. And I can't help but think that this maybe hindered his England career as well, because he certainly wasn't a yes man.
No.
But I think the Ian Wright we see these days is not the Ian Wright of then. I'm almost sure. Yeah. You know?
Just before I get the chisel out to go and get Ian Wright's likeness on the guy, I just want to make sure I've got the right here. We're not talking about the bus driver here, are we? No, I mean, I think, you know, I think everybody would agree, a bit like the Kenny Sansom choice, that, you know, it has to be Ian Wright as a forward for Crystal Palace. So let's put him up there. And just before we sort of finish, Dad, I just want to, if you had to pick who was Mr. Crystal Palace for a player? Now, you can pick one of the guys you've mentioned or someone else entirely if you want to, but if I say to you, David, who's Mr. Crystal Palace as a player?
It's a cigarette paper between Kenny Sansom and Ian Wright, but I'm going to give it to Ian Wright purely because I don't know why. Ian Wright because he's Ian Wright.
I think he's a likable character as well, isn't he? He's got that.
Kenny's likable as well. Kenny, I've never heard a bad word about Kenny, but Kenny was a left back and Ian Wright was a forward. We all know forwards get the glory.
Don't they just. Aidan, any arguments with that, or are you in sort of stepping in line with that, mate?
Oh, totally agree. You know, this is a person who has become so synonymous with Arsenal, but according to my sources of Wikipedia, he played more times for Crystal Palace than he did for Arsenal. So he is more of a Crystal Palace man than he is for an Arsenal one. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. So Mr. Crystal Palace he is.
Good bit of stats there, Aidan. Good bit of stats.
I'll be interested to see, Gary, if you get an Arsenal guy on here to do the Mount Rushmore, whether it ever Henry or Wright will be the number one, or Bergkamp. Yeah. It'll be interesting to see.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, we've sort of come to the end of Series 2, and I've already got people approaching me about doing another one. So it might happen. We'll see.
Well, we'll tell them Ian Wright's taken. I'll have to pick from someone else.
I'll chisel him with a blue and red stripe. So, because I can do that, I'll do a little bit of gradient on the stripes, I can make that work for you. But if, anyway, that was great, David. So thanks for coming on and telling us about your Crystal Palace heroes. And I'm going to, as soon as we finish, I'm going to get the hammer and chisels out. I'll be down to South London and I'll be getting to work. And next time you go and see Palace play, if you look at that mountain above the stand, you'll see there and you'll see the players and you'll say, that's your choices, mate. Your choices.
Gary, you can't kid me, mate. A Chelsea fan going down to South London and working? Eh?
He's got you there,
it's not worth
it to
have to labour
of
love, so...
No, you're right, mate. Thank you very much, guys. I've enjoyed it. I've really enjoyed it. I love talking about Crystal Palace. Football in general, but especially Crystal Palace.
Good stuff, mate. Good stuff. You enjoy it, Aidan?
Oh, totally. As always, these episodes are an education and cracking fun. Yeah. And there's always so many great stories and the reasons people pick the players. You know, we could all think of the players they pick, but it's all about the reasons and it's very personal in those respects. But it's always terrific to hear. So, yeah, great fun. Loved it.
Okay, that's great. So just for me now to say thanks to the listeners for listening to the Crystal Palace version of Mount Rushmore. And catch us next time for the concluding episode of Series 2, and we'll be looking at a different type of team, not a club team, a national team. Catch us then. Cheers. Bye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.